It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Stuart Vonnie.
I'm Martha McCallum.
I'm Jason Chaffetz, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, November 9th, 2023. I'm Dave Anthony. Israel's war against Hamas is generating a lot of protests here, many of them pro-Palestinians on the left who are upsetting some of their fellow Democrats who call it anti-Semitic.
The problem is their fighting's coming from inside the tent. You know, they're chanting genocide Joe. They're not saying genocide Hamas. You know, they have a problem with their own president that they elected. It's our president, but that's their party.
We talk with Fox's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. There were multiple elections this week in various states, and one topic tied multiple races together. It was one that clearly, by the results, drove Democrats to the polls.
People are coming out on the issue of abortion. They're not necessarily coming out for their candidates. This issue is one that is transcending a lot more.
And I'm Stephen Moore. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
While Israelis keep waging war against Hamas in Gaza, protesters keep raging here in the U.S.
Genocide Joe has got to go!
That's in Washington, D.C. Pro-Palestinian demonstrators calling out President Biden for supporting Israel.
Free Gaza! Free Gaza!
That's a protester chanting, Free Gaza! Escorted yesterday out of a House hearing investigating anti-Semitism at colleges.
Jewish students are being physically threatened and have legitimate cause to fear for their safety on campuses across the country.
That's Democratic Congressman Jerry Nadler. One of his colleagues, Rashida Tlaib, was censured by the House for her pro-Palestinian comments, including a chant that really upset her fellow lawmakers, including Congressman Brad Schneider, one of the 22 Democrats who voted with Republicans to publicly reprimand Tlaib.
The statement, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, is a rallying cry. It is an aspirational rallying cry, an aspiration for the destruction of the state of Israel.
But Congresswoman Tlaib remains defiant.
Trying to bully or censor me won't work, because this movement for a ceasefire is much bigger than one person.
And there's no end in sight to the war or the protests.
What strikes me is you need a degree of understanding. It is not right or wrong, George Floyd. We know who's right or wrong.
Brian Kilmeade co-hosts Fox and Friends weekday mornings on Fox News Channel, followed by his show on Fox News Radio.
It's not equality. It's not something that we can figure out. Women voting, obviously, where we stand on that. We all, 1990, we get it. But if you want to protest the Palestinians or support Israel, you got to do some research. Well, who was there? Why were they there? How many peace agreements were attempted? Who runs the Gaza Strip? Mm-hmm. How come there has been an election since Hamas won the last one? What's the popularity there? Did they actually do that thing on October 7th? And what was it in response to? Why were the Israelis under the impression that Hamas was looking to run the Gaza Strip? How were they so in the dark? So having said all that, you need to go to school. And if you come out of that and go, it's really Palestinians are the victims here, I like to hear your argument. I feel bad for all those people that have been forced south, but the reason why they did it is because the people that run the Gaza Strip chopped up and killed 1,400 people and took 200 hostage. They have no choice. They are texting. They're dropping flyers. Dave, did you see any texts or flyers to get out of the kibbutzes on October 7th?
No, there's none of that. But the people who are doing a lot of the protesting, they say it's genocide because there's 10,000 Palestinians killed in the Israeli strikes. Right, according to Hamas. And they say that thousands of them are women and children. And we certainly have seen a lot of civilians fleeing in UN shelters and all. So they believe that they are the real victims in all this at this point. So how do you stop that issue or make it? I mean, how do you change their plight?
What you do is you let them know that this is the way to be safe. But in the meantime, the people that run the Gaza Strip, I wouldn't say country, your portion of land, have to be brought to justice. Death or detainment have to be brought to justice.
On college campuses, the protests have been very strong. And of course, with Congresswoman Tlaib being censured for her comments, how can we find a way where both sides can have dialogue? Because it seems to be very hard.
Here, I don't know, but I'm fascinated because the problem is their fighting's coming from inside the tent. You know, they're chanting Genocide Joe. They're not saying Genocide Hamas. You know, they have a problem with their own president that they elected. It's our president, but that's their party. And their problem is with their party. 22 congressmen were Democrats that voted for her censure.
Mm-hmm.
So before we as the general public can try to find a way, maybe they as a party should try to get a message that comes out. Now, nobody wants an innocent Palestinian to die. But when you kill 1,400 innocents because it was October 7th, there's going to be repercussions. There's no world in which there isn't.
Hamas might have expected this, right? They would have known that Israel is going to have a long conflict in Gaza. And they may have counted on people tiring of the daily war there.
Like we're famous in the West for doing, like Ukraine, like Afghanistan, like Iraq. What happens after is key. And I thought when Benjamin Netanyahu came out and said, we're going to control Gaza for a while.
Which the U.S. doesn't want, supposedly.
Right. But do you have a choice? Do you have anybody else? So we know what it was like. We turned over Mosul and these other cities to the local governors. They started rocketing our embassy. We had to go back in there block by block. If they pull out and say, now, you guys, now go get Mahmoud Abbas in there to run things, any remnants of Hamas reconfigured, retrained in Iran, sent right back, militarized again 7 years later, new generation of Israelis, new 8-year-olds taken captive or killed. So they want to end this thing for good. Until you can prove to them the security can be held by anybody else, I think they hold it.
Brian has a new book just out today, another one looking back at our history. It's titled Teddy and Booker T, How Two American Icons Blazed a Path for Racial Equality, linking Theodore Roosevelt, a war hero who became president in 1901, and Booker T. Washington, an influential black man in the post-Civil War South.
People go, wait a second, this guy, one of the most respected men in America, as an educator without peer, who's changing the way race relations are envisioned and internalized, who is known as well in the UK and in Europe. And he started as a slave? Is that the story? Yeah, that's the story. And he needed partners. And one of the partners and the man of power is Teddy Roosevelt, who found up from slavery and wrote a letter and said, I got to meet you.
Mm.
And then they decided, he was vice president. They just said, when I'm president, if I get there, I'm going to work with you. He goes, I'd love that. He became president when McKinley gets shot. And immediately he calls for Booker. And they worked together for 7.5 years and had a lifelong friendship.
So the day he is sworn in as president when McKinley dies, he writes a letter to Booker T and invites him. But their meeting...
He also apologized for having to put off their meeting.
But their meeting is a dinner at the White House. And I don't think either of them expected the reaction they got.
It was horrendous. And America was not ready for a black man, even Booker T. Washington, to eat with a white family, happened to be the first family of the country.
With black servants, right, in the
great
executive
point.
Mansion?
Great point. And it was so impactful, it rippled throughout the South. I mean, I can't even read the headlines out loud. I included them in the book. In the North, it was not that big of a deal. And there were times, Frederick Douglass, I found this out when Governor Roosevelt was governor of New York. He had blacks all the time. He's like, why don't you stay and sleep over? He's like, I got this huge mansion. Why don't you stay? Oh, absolutely. He didn't think anything of it. He's like, I got to work with this guy. When we're done with dinner, let's go in the study and let's go work some more. So they both were so blown away by the negative reaction, they realized they might have hurt their cause. And that was the worst thing. But John McCain mentioned the dinner and the outrage that surrounded it when he lost in 2008. And he said, you know, decades ago, it was a big deal when a black man came to eat with a white president. Now, well, that black man will be hosting the next dinner. Look how far America's come.
Yeah.
And that's why I wanted to do it. Before you take a knee at a football game, which is your right, or take a knee at a World Cup game, which is your right, I think you should have a perspective on how hard people worked and how much they sacrificed in order to move America forward. Fundamentally, they agreed on one thing. They loved the country. They wanted to make it better they knew it was the best around. And they both had opportunities to go anywhere. Teddy Roosevelt, not just a rich guy, he had asthma, he had huge intestinal issues, could never leave the house as a kid. He went through a hellacious upbringing where all he could do was feed his mind, not build his body. He overcame that the rest of his life.
When you talk about Booker T. Washington, one of the things that I find interesting is that some people, as the movement for freedom grew, some people were critical of him because, for instance, his speech that was so well thought of in 1895 in Atlanta, Georgia, didn't really call for a conflict or a clash. He talked about blacks and whites living together, but in the framework of the culture of the time, it wasn't calling for a change, calling for them to live together, even though they were considered by the whites unequal.
If he was too much of an activist, Tuskegee would have paid the price. And he had to do the impossible in the South, address a black and white audience who wanted to hear something different. And he both gave them what they wanted. And a lot of people had tears in their eyes saying, listen, I know how you feel about us. I know how we feel about you. We're not a threat to you. We just like an opportunity to live our dreams too. And he told white people, you know, you do what you do, we'll do what we do, but keep an eye on us because no one's going to stop us. We're on a roll and the sky's the limit. And at the end of it, I think it was Grover Cleveland was in the audience and he couldn't believe how great this speech was and how on the money it was and how motivational it was. And it was printed everywhere because I think fundamentally white people knew the injustice of segregation and they know what to do about it. Just like in slavery, you read Jefferson, you read Washington, they go, slavery is awful, but how do I get out of it? Mm. I was born into it.
Took a long time.
How do I get out of it?
Took a long time.
And they used
time.
To say to John Adams, yeah, you're condemning us, but you're in the North. You don't need labor, right? You know, so you're living a businessman's life. We're there. If I let go of all my slaves, I lose everything. And as is, just do it anyway. I know people watching at home, but just put yourself in the mind of 1750, not in 2023. So they said, listen, this is what we're in. Just watch me. And all he did was get more and more fans and supporters. You tell people they're evil and they're bad and we're coming for you. Even if you are wrong, you're going to be defensive. You're not going to help them. At the end of this, Andrew Carnegie, Julian Rosenwald, J.P. Morgan, how can I help? What can I do? They made him take a vacation. He goes, listen, you're working too hard. I want to pay your salary. You got to retire. He goes, no, if you give me money, it's going to the school. And they go, will you at least take a vacation? They were worried about him. Wait, a rich black man, the richest man in the world, worried about this guy who runs a school and a historical black college in the South. And it shows you the goodness of people, even though they were in a time in which segregation and racism was rampant. But they saw the goodness in a person. And I can imagine how many people were inspired seeing this black man from the South work with this guy from the North called Teddy Roosevelt. How many people looked at them and said, or little black kids and little white kids go, I don't see any difference in race. If they could work together, I can. They never really wrote an autobiography. We might not know how many people they inspired. But the relationship, I think, is worth chronicling.
The book is Teddy and Booker T., How Two American Icons Blazed a Path for Racial Equality. Brian Kilmeade, host, of course, of Fox and Friends, weekday mornings, The Ryan Kilmeade Show and the new book. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks,
Appreciate
Brian. It. Good to see you.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
This is Stephen Moore with your Fox News commentary coming up.
When Democrats went to vote Tuesday, abortion may have been on their minds. In the now red state of Ohio, 56% of voters approved Measure 1, amending the state constitution to preserve an individual's right to make and carry out one's own reproductive decisions. That would include birth control, fertility treatments, miscarriage, and abortion. Veronica Ingham was the campaign manager for the abortion issue in Ohio, and she said Wednesday morning,
because Ohioans value reproductive freedom, support abortion rights, and saw through the anti-abortion extremist lies.
In Virginia, abortion was not on the ballot, but the state's Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin, had discussed trying to pass a ban on abortion after 15 weeks, with exceptions. To get it through the legislature, he campaigned to keep the House Republican and flip the state Senate to Republican.
I think one of my aspirations was to find a place to come together on one of these most difficult topics. So abortion is potentially one of the most difficult topics in Virginia and around the nation.
Democrats not only held the state Senate, but they took back control of the state House. And in Kentucky, where there's a total ban on abortion, incumbent Democratic Governor Andy Beshear held onto the seat in the red state. And after he won, he thanked young woman Hadley Duvall, who appeared in this ad for Beshear.
I was raped by my stepfather after years of sexual abuse. I was 12. Anyone who believes there should be no exceptions for rape and incest could never understand what it's like to stand in my shoes. This is to you, Daniel Cameron.
Cameron, the state's Republican attorney general who supported Kentucky's abortion ban, lost to Beshear. Now with these results in hand, the pundits and pollsters look ahead to what all of this means for 2024.
So we've seen this for a while. Abortion is a very, very big issue, and it's not necessarily coming up in the polls as what issues are most important to your day-to-day life.
Lee Carter is president of Maslansky & Partners.
What we are seeing is that if you think back to the Ohio generic ballot initiative on abortion, it had record turnout, and we saw the same thing happen at the polls, and we saw also in the midterms. People are coming out on the issue of abortion. They're not necessarily coming out for their candidates. This issue is one that is transcending a lot more. And we've seen this in polling. About 7 in 10 independent women say one of the primary reasons that they're going to go to the polls if they're in a state where this is an issue is abortion. 9 out of 10 Democrats say the primary reason they're going to go to the polls if this is an issue that's important to their state, that's going to be the primary driver. So this is going to be a real issue for Republicans going into 2024.
When it comes to Ohio, right, this is no longer a swing state, right? It's red. And yet voters, as you noted, went to the polls to enshrine a right to an abortion in their constitution, right? I mean, how significant is that for that to have happened in Ohio?
I think it's very significant. And I think what Republicans need to remember, certainly those that are running for office, is this isn't just about abortion and people saying, I need to get an abortion. This is many people saying this is about protecting mothers. It's about protecting choice. And historically, whenever you're on the side of banning or boycotting, you're losing. And no matter what that issue is, when you're on the side of banning or boycotting, abortion in this case, it's a losing issue. It's very antithetical to American values, where we believe that we have freedom to choose, that we don't want government involved in all of our decisions. So it's a really hard thing to understand if you are pro-life and you think that child is a human being that deserves protection. But most people are looking at this saying this is a woman's right to choose. And actually, if you take that away from us, we're going to be putting women backwards. And so when you look at a state like Ohio, which is a red-leaning state, you're going to see that there's been a big shift and big movement on how people view this. And interestingly enough, in September, Donald Trump was really talking about how important of an issue this is. He said, look, we took Roe versus Wade back, but he really talks about how Republicans haven't been able to articulate a message on this. And he talks about how Ron DeSantis' ban on abortion was a big political misstep, and he's not wrong. It's a very, very important issue to women and one that could really change the dynamics in 2024.
And in Virginia, how much of a factor was abortion, do you think? I know there were a lot of ads about it, but abortion wasn't on the ballot, right? It was the Republican governor saying that if he has a Republican legislature, he could get a ban passed. I know he backed off the word ban, but that he could get like sort of a 15-week ban passed if he had a Republican legislature. What was that driving voters in these, state House and state Senate races?
I think there's no question that it absolutely drove voters out. And this is a big upset for Youngkin. I think he was going to use this as a, launching pad for his more nationwide platform, and it failed. And I think the thing that he walked back the language of bans too late. The fact that he was actually putting out a choice to 15 weeks is one that is pretty progressive as far as Republicans goes. And I think he really misspoke from a language and messaging perspective. I think his policy actually is one that many people would agree with. If you look at polling on how people view this, I think most people agree that 15 weeks is by is a time where a woman should be able to make a decision. And it's in line with what we see with laws all over the world, not just here in the United States. So I think he, in his language, made it sound like he was more right than he in fact was. And, you know, the Democrats certainly use that in advertisements over and over again. And I can't emphasize this enough. When you are talking about banning, you are going to lose in almost every issue. Americans do not like the concept of bans.
So then, Lee, what's the path forward for Republicans? Because the Republicans would propose, right? If you ask Glenn Youngkin, if you ask a Tim Scott, they would say, let's try a 15-week what? Because anything you say there, any law you pass there, a federal law that says we're going to put a cap at a week marker, Democrats are going to turn around and say that is a ban. And so you, even if you don't use the word ban or boycott, the other side will.
That's right. And I think Democrats are smart to use that language. It's one that really resonates for their cause. So Republicans, I think, are going to have to find a very pro-woman message that it goes beyond just the 15-week decision period, which is maybe what you can talk about it as. Say people, you know, women have a right to abortion up to 15 weeks, have a decision period. But they need a pro-woman, pro-mother agenda. Because one of the things that you think about a woman right now who's struggling to make ends meet, who might not have a father with a job at home, might have multiple children and already can't afford. If she gets pregnant, what choice does she have? And what are we going to provide her so that the easiest choice or the best choice for her is to keep that child? So Republicans need to find a message that includes a very pro-mother, pro-woman platform that they don't have right now. Right now they're seen as almost anti-woman, as if you're choosing the baby over the mother. And what it has to be is something that's like, if this is an all of the above solution where we want to make it the easiest decision for women to choose the baby as well.
Yeah, they tell you when you're pregnant or when your kids are young that, you know, the best thing for them is a happy and stable mom. So if you go down this road, you know, helping women, does that cost money? You know, are we talking about like paid leave? Does this open up a whole can of worms, like where you need to figure out some policy here if you're going to encourage women to keep their babies?
Yeah, you do. I mean, there are absolute policy ramifications here. And whether it is paid leave or whether it's figuring out how to continue support for Head Start or whether it is universal child care or access of some kind or tax credits to women who make this decision who need the help, there's got to be some policy implication here that says it's beyond making this just about choosing the baby over the mother. We've got to have support for the mother that makes the right decision. Thankfully, I'm not in the policy making arena, but there's no doubt that they're going to have to reckon with this.
Just a couple more for you. It sounds like you're saying, in no uncertain terms, this is now a single issue for a lot of voters, for that desired independent suburban woman, mom voter, that swing voter. This for her, this is a single issue topic, voting topic.
That's correct. Now, what does that mean in terms of, you know, the presidential election next year? Well, Joe Biden is really unpopular. He's losing in a lot of polls. But what we are seeing is that Kennedy is polling really well. I mean, he's got 24% of the vote in some of the most recent polls. So what does that mean? It could mean that independent women who say, I can't stand Biden, but I wouldn't vote for Trump, are going to vote for a third party candidate who might be more moderate. What does that do? The advantage there might go to Donald Trump in that case. But I think that Republicans would make a huge mistake if they don't deal with this. And I think Nikki Haley knows that. She talked about it in the last debate, said this is going to be, you know, what we're going to have to reckon with if the Democrats have a big night on election night. And they did.
Yeah, I think my last one for you is, it kind of dovetails with that. You know, we look at these poll numbers that just came out of the New York Times, where voters in 5 of 6 swing states go for Trump over Biden. Like you just said, he's the president suffering with his poll numbers. So on the presidential level, just on the presidential level, you look at those numbers. Does abortion not matter? Are voters sort of parsing this and saying this is different at that level? We need to, if you're going to vote on abortion, that might be a state's issue.
I think they might be parsing it. We're seeing a lot of results where you have a split legislator from the governorship, and I think we might see the same thing happen at the federal level. But I think when it comes to looking at that polling, it's important to remember that there's certain states where this is mattering the most, and those are where abortion really is on the ballot. So So when you look at those swing states where Trump is winning, those aren't necessarily the states that are most concerned about this issue. But I also have a couple of caveats that I want to talk about. Number one, Joe Biden's polling is abysmal. And in this moment, the only polling that's worse than his is the approval rating of Republicans in Congress. So what we saw really might be a problem that Republicans are having because they're seen as a divided party. People aren't sure what they're getting, who they are. You know, there's so much infighting within the party. It seems like there's almost three parties within a party. So what is this all about? I think when we get to the election next year, there could be an answer to that. If Donald Trump's in charge, we'll know exactly what we're getting, and people need to get in line. But part of the problem that we saw, Republicans don't have a single platform, a single policy. We don't know what it means to be a Republican today. Does it mean that we're the party of Donald Trump? Does it mean that we're typical conservatives? Does it mean, what does it mean? And I think that is something that Republicans wrestle with. And certainly by the election day of next year, there needs to be a clear answer to.
Lee Carter, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
Meet the American who
popularized the drinking straw. Humans have long sipped the liquid pleasures of life through hollow pieces of glass or straw. But after inspiration hit Marvin Stone when he was drinking a mint julep in the late 1800s, the industry would be forever changed. Marvin Chester Stone was born in Portage County, Ohio on April 4th, 1842, and was always said to be a curious boy with a tinkerer's mind. His smarts led him to study at Oberlin College in Ohio, but his university career was cut short after the nation erupted in civil war. Stone promptly left his studies to join the 7th Ohio Volunteer Infantry as a private. Though after harrowing battles in Gettysburg and Chancellorsville left Stone wounded, he was disabled from active duty. His next stop would be Washington, D.C., where he was sent to recover. Here, Stone initially set out to manufacture paper cigarette holders, but it wouldn't take long for his career to take a revolutionary turn. After work one day, rumor has it that Stone was sipping a mint julep through a hollow piece of rye grass. When he got caught up in his dissatisfaction with the way the grass was disintegrating into his drink, leaving an unpleasant residue, and knowing that glass straws were considered a luxury item, Stone wanted to invent something new that would be effective and accessible. Thus, the paper straw was born. His first model was created when Stone wrapped strips of paper around a pencil, removed them, and then glued them together. But soon after, he fashioned a sturdier version made of manila paper coated in paraffin that proved to be a bit more resistant to sogginess. Before he knew it, Stone received the patent for his artificial straw in 1888, and by 1890, his straws had taken the world by storm. Decades later, however, the paper straw business took a major hit when the plastic straw was introduced to the industry. In the 1860s, when the plastic straw rose to stardom, it quickly became the product of choice for both producers and consumers due to cheaper, easier to produce, and far sturdier than paper. Though plastic straws weren't perfect, which is something many Americans began paying attention to in just the last few years, around 2017, plastic straws began being condemned worldwide for the harm they were doing to the environment, polluting beaches, endangering wildlife, and releasing chemicals into the atmosphere. After those concerns swept the nation, Marvin Stone's company, which eventually became Aardvark Straws, saw a 4,900% increase in paper straw sales from 2017 to 2018. Fast forward to now, and the U.S. paper straw market is expected to grow from $1.51 billion to $2.23 billion in 2030, all thanks to Marvin Stone, a mint julep, and a revolutionary invention. I'm Gianna Gelosi. Go to the lifestyle section of foxnews.com for more of these incredible American stories.
Hey, it's Will Cain, co-host of Fox and Friends Weekend. Join me as I share my thoughts on a wide range of topics, from sports and pop culture to politics and business.
The Will Cain Podcast. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary. Stephen Moore.
What's on your mind?
In announcing his move from Seattle to Miami, Jeff Bezos has become the latest of a long procession of prominent business icons and celebrities to abandon blue state for red state America. As the man who built the trillion-dollar tech behemoth, Amazon, he is now the wealthiest American to flee to a low-tax state. There is a cautionary tale here for blue state America, which day after day is being bled to death by this steady stream of migration of millions of people and tens of billions of capital to red states. Washington State was, until recently, the only blue state in America with no income tax. For many years, it also had no inheritance or no capital gains tax. This light taxation on business investment and income contributed to Washington becoming one of the fastest growing states and a mecca for world-class businesses, a list that includes Microsoft, Amazon, Costco, and Starbucks. Being one of nine states with a zero income tax was in many ways Washington's greatest comparative advantage, especially because neighboring California and Oregon had among the highest income tax rates, both above 10%. But that's all ended. Progressives in Seattle took charge and started the relentless Soak the Rich campaign. This started with the state adopting a death tax that can reach 19% for millionaires and billionaires in Washington. That's one of the highest rates in the nation, all for the privilege of dying in Washington state. That is something Jeff Bezos has decided he will not do. Then last year, the state adopted a 6% capital gains tax, even though the state's constitution prohibits an income tax. There may be no one on the planet that has more capital gains than Jeff Bezos. And now the legislature is debating a 1% annual income tax. Who do you think they had in mind to pay that? So you answer the question. Is it just the sunny weather that is driving Mr. Bezos to flee? Bezos stated in his announcement that he has amazing memories of Seattle, where he's lived for three decades and built Amazon. Bezos never mentioned the tax advantages of residing in Florida, and almost no one in the media, not CNN, not the New York Times, not CNBC, mentioned the tax advantages of this relocation to Florida. I don't know anything about Jeff Bezos' personal finances, but he has formed one of the largest family foundations in the world with multi-billions of dollars of his wealth that now will forever escape taxation. Bezos' politics swing liberal, but almost nobody forks over money to the tax man if they don't have to. Tax avoidance is one of the world's oldest businesses and a grand American tradition dating back to the Boston Tea Party. Washington State may learn a painful lesson here. If you sock it to the rich will get out of Dodge. Bezos declared that Seattle will always have a place in my heart, but not his wallet. I'm Stephen Moore, a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation and a co-founder of the Committee to Unleash Prosperity. My latest book is Govzilla, How the Relentless Growth of Government is Devouring Our Economy.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com. From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow Podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.